Today we will be looking at Exodus 19 through 20:21. As usual, I pretty much stop in the middle of a chapter, so I apologize again. But this is the arrival of the people at Mount Sinai. This is God's theophany to them and his initial address to them. This is going to be the first of 3 weeks on the Old Covenant or the Mosaic Covenant or the Sinai Covenant. It goes by a bunch of names. This week is going to be essentially the preamble. Like I just spoke, it is the arrival. It is the initial discussion between Moses and God, between God and the people. And then next week is the extension and the application of this opening, basically introductory material and summary. We're going to see that next week. And then the third week, after Moses receives more detailed instructions and laws, we're going to see in chapter 4 the covenant confirmation ceremony. And that is also why we are going to do the Lord's Supper the second week of February, not the first week of February, because I just thought it'd be really cool to line up our fellowship meal as part of the new covenant with when we learn about the old covenant confirmation meal. We will see that there are a couple different meals in that chapter. So I just thought the timing was really cool. I know it shifts us back a week, but close enough, and I just think it's going to be a really cool way to further show what is happening in that chapter. So we're going to bump that back just 1 week. And as we begin today, I'm not going to reread the verses that were just read. We just read 1 through 15, which was the arrival and then God's call to prepare themselves for his theophany. Now, you may have noticed something as you were reading there. I'm not going to go too much into it. But you notice how Moses went on to the mountain to talk to God and then comes down, and then God says, I'm going to come down onto the mountain. Like, Moses just went up there to talk to him, but then God says he's going to come down to where he just was. As a lot of times in Scripture, what we see here is a more glorious manifestation, or more glorious showing of God's presence. God is omnipresent. He's present everywhere. But what he's going to do is being done and demonstrated for a point. So it's not that he wasn't at the mountain already. He's everywhere already, so that's not the point. The point is he's about to show something. And there's a point to everything that's going to be happening. So we're going to walk through that. So I just want to point out that if you were noticing as we were reading there. But the first thing we're going to talk about here is the fact that the people have finally now arrived at Mount Sinai. And this is kind of a big deal. And if you look at how the Pentateuch or the first five books of the Bible are broken down, you see that this is actually a really big deal. Because they arrive at Mount Sinai here in Exodus 19. It is not until the 10th chapter of Numbers that the people leave Mount Sinai. So you have almost two complete books. You have half of Exodus, you have all of Leviticus, and you have the first 10 chapters of Numbers, all happening here at Mount Sinai. So remember how I talked about with the first nine plagues going like super fast through the nine plagues, and also in this 10th plague, we have like, was it two or three chapters? We dramatically slow down. You have 77 verses about just the 10th plague. That's happening again here at Mount Sinai. We have traveled from Egypt to here in the matter of just four chapters, I think. And now all of a sudden we're slowing down for almost two entire books of the Bible worth, where the people are at one location. There's a lot of stuff happening here, and this is the very beginning of it. This is also the fulfillment of a promise that God gave Moses back in Exodus 3:12, where he said that the sign that he would deliver the people and that he would be with Moses was that Moses would return to the mountain where the burning bush happens. So this is the same mountain. Now, as I talked about a couple weeks ago, that doesn't mean we really know where it is. There are a bunch of theories about where it is. But what's significant is that it is the same mountain, wherever that happens to be. And it is so significant here, this arrival, because, as we are going to see, it inaugurates the final stage of forming Israel's national and spiritual identity. They have just been delivered. They have been reborn, as we saw a couple weeks ago, through the crossing of the water and the imagery being used there of a recreation of the nation of Israel. And now here at Sinai, they are going to be forged and formed into a nation with a new covenant, a new identity. Before we begin working through the text itself, though, I want to talk a bit about and address briefly what exactly it means and what it doesn't mean that the people are entering a covenant. The first thing to consider is that Israel is already said to be God's people. They are already called God's firstborn son, explicitly, in Exodus 4:22. So this isn't Israel becoming the people of God. They already are. He has delivered his people. He promised to save his son. He had Moses go to Pharaoh and say, "Let my firstborn go." That makes it pretty obvious that they're already God's people. So that isn't what's going on here. It's not just this random group of people that have just randomly arrived at Mount Sinai and God randomly chooses them and says, "Do you want to enter a covenant with me?" That's not what's going on here. They already are God's people. There is a history here. And I'm going to bring that up again when we get to the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments have a context. There is a reason that the Ten Commandments start with, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt." Israel, therefore, was not entering a covenant, not obeying a set of laws to become God's people. They were entering into a covenant because they already were God's people. The covenant defines their relationship with Yahweh. It was God's way of explaining to them how to show that they believe him and are loyal to him. Obedience, old and new covenant, never earns merit, never gets you into relationship with God. It is belief that does this, not works. Old and new covenant. Belief and God's gracious choice and desire to dwell with and be in relationship with people. What obedience does is show our belief and our loyalty. Disobedience shows disbelief and disloyalty. This is why the punishment of many more serious sins was to be cut off. We addressed that a lot in Leviticus last year. This was done because those who were committing these sins were showing that they did not want to live in covenant with God. They were showing that they did not believe and that they were not loyal. This is why in the new covenant, unrepentant sin leads to excommunication or being cut off. Basically the same exact thing in the old covenant, still the same in the new covenant. This is because those who are unrepentant, though they have professed faith, show that they do not believe and that they do not want to live in covenant with God. The covenant, then, is God's way of saying, "You are my people. I have revealed myself to you, to Israel." He reminds them that I have delivered you, I have brought you here. "I am going to teach you even more about myself and how you can demonstrate your belief in me and loyalty to me by worshiping me, living in line with my character and honoring my creation, especially each other, because you are all my image bearers." The covenant is a call and instructions for God's people to demonstrate believing loyalty and to image him in their relationships to each other and the surrounding world. I'm going to bring up believing loyalty a lot because that is the key to the covenant. It is a call to those who believe God to live out their belief by loving him supremely and loving others according to his good instructions. Wait, that sounds really familiar. We'll get back there. As we work through the text and look at this covenant and what is happening, I want to first look at verses 3 through 6. This is the invitation to the covenant. What we saw in those verses is that God, through Moses, reminds the people how he has borne them on eagle's wings out of the bondage of Egypt to himself. He has brought them here to Sinai from the bondage of Egypt. He has revealed himself and his power to them. If then they believe in him and choose to be loyal to him, he calls them to obey his voice and keep his covenant, which is about to be explained later. But this is the opening invitation to it. It's kind of like an opening ceremony, if you want. They will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. both terms that promise that they will have their own nation, which they've already been told, and terms that define their role to the world around them. They are to be a nation set apart as imagers, priests of God, to be a teaching and a light to the world around them. This is their call to the covenant. If you believe in me, enter into this covenant with me, and you will be a kingdom of priests. This covenant invitation is accepted, and then preparations need to be made for the preparation, for the arrival of God. In 7 to 15, we read that the people accept God's invitation. In other words, they declare their belief in God and readiness to obey what he has to say. When Moses reports the answer of the people to God, God instructs Moses and the people to ready themselves for the third day, when God will make his presence known and will begin formally giving the terms and instructions of the covenant. God explains first that his visible presence and audible voice will confirm to the people that the instructions they are getting from Moses are not from Moses. They are from God. We see this explicitly in verse 9. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am coming to you in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with you, and may also believe you forever." We're going to see that made more explicit as we work through the text here. This is to remind the people and show the people that though we will see, they will hear from God a little bit. Moses is going to get a lot more instruction, but it is to set the tone and remind the people that all this instruction they are receiving is directly from God, even the instruction that's mediated through Moses. And God then explains that his presence must be prepared for through consecrating themselves. This time of preparation, this couple days delay, gave them the time to purify themselves for proximity to the presence of God, something that we talked about a lot last year in Leviticus. And it also gave them time to consider and reflect on the covenant that they're about to enter. The instruction begins, what we will see as we continue through the book of Exodus, the instruction begins what will be a three-section division of Mount Sinai, where only certain people are allowed in certain sections, a format that will be echoed later in the tabernacle and later in the temple. And the connections between these two, the tabernacle and Mount Sinai, are going to be reinforced quite often as we work through this book. So when we read this text, as you think about the up and the down, and why are they going up and down and so much, and different people going to different stages, different heights all the time, it's because of a teaching that is happening. It is because of sacred space. Again, something we addressed a lot in Leviticus. I'm not going to rehash it all there, but that is what's being taught. Only certain people are allowed to certain proximity levels, and those people have to go through certain consecration to get to the level that they're at. And then in verses 16 to 25, we see God descend on the mountain. I'm going to read this. Verses 16 to 25. On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke, because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. And Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. And the Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain. And the Lord called Moses up to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go down and warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord to look, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them." And Moses said to the Lord, "The people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you yourself warned us, saying, 'Set limits around the mountain and consecrate it.' And the Lord said to him, 'Go down and come up, bringing Aaron with you. But do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them.' So Moses went down to the people and told them." The section began, "On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning and thick cloud." We read of the smoke as of a kiln and a great fire descending on the mountain. We read of loud trumpet blasts. God's arrival is signified by the most powerful forces on earth, all happening in one place at one time. A fierce storm of thunder and lightning, the trembling of an earthquake, the smoke and fire as of a tremendous kiln, all testify that the God of the universe, the God who defeated all the gods of Egypt and demonstrated his power over all the force of the nature, the Lord of all, has arrived. This is sensory theology. And this is a sensory theology that is continued throughout the Bible. You read of these forces of lightning and thunder, of trumpets, of earthquakes, of fire. That sounds a lot like a lot of prophets, and that sounds a lot like Revelation. This is sensory theology that's taught through the whole Bible. God using and ushering in all of the greatest forces and all of the greatest sensory experiences on earth to show that he is over all. And notice that he is not in any of them. They all simply show and demonstrate his arrival. This isn't like the other pagan gods where God is thunder, God is lightning, God is fire. No, God created all of them. They are all simply trumpets, announcements that he is here. Moses then brings the people to the base of the mountain. And as the sound of the heavenly trumpets gets louder and louder, and I would argue they are heavenly trumpets because we see two different words used for trumpets throughout. One of them tends to be used as the heavenly trumpets throughout the Bible. Moses speaks and God answers him in thunder. We read elsewhere that the voice of the Lord shook the ground. This is again triumphant and magnificent, glorious sensory theology. The ground itself shakes when God talks. The first thing that the Lord does is call Moses up to meet him to the top of the mountain. Sorry, my pages are not cooperating with me today. One second. So he calls Moses up to the top of the mountain to tell him the same thing that he had already told him. And even Moses is confused. And then God tells him to go back and get Aaron and warn the people, the same thing he had already warned them. This seems a bit anticlimactic. Even Moses goes up there and is like, you already told me this. Why am I coming up here to tell them the same exact thing? I think in addition to the repeated warning to show the severity of improperly entering God's presence, a pattern that is set here and that is seen later in Nadab and Abihu being burnt when they improperly enter the Holy of Holies, when Uzzah is killed, when he touches to try to steady the Ark of the Covenant, there is a message there. But I also think that there is another pattern being set here. What better way to declare that Moses is God's chosen servant and leader than for as all of the glory of this theophany is shown, as the ground itself shakes and the people tremble as we read elsewhere, that just Moses is called up? What better way to declare that he is God's chosen servant and leader, who even as the people are terrified, is called to closer presence with God? He alone is called up, and then he is told to bring up Aaron next, after he himself has been alone brought up there. What more clear way, just as we read back earlier in the chapter, what more clear way could God have told the people to listen to Moses? The heavens display the glory of God. God descends, his voice is heard, and he effectively tells the people, just as he promised Moses that he would, he tells the people to listen to Moses by singling him out. Wait, I sense another pattern here. This sounds a lot like the baptism of Christ, where the heavens open, the dove, the presence of God descends, and a voice from heaven is heard saying, "This is my son." This sounds a lot like the transfiguration, where a bright cloud appears and the voice of God is heard saying, "This is my son, listen to him." There is a pattern being set here. And then after Moses warns the people again, the next thing we read is the Ten Commandments. This has honestly caused a lot of debate about the order of events here. Moses is going up, then he goes down, and then right for the Ten Commandments, we read that he goes back up. And there's no like segue here that God is talking to the people. But it is interesting that the text just says, "And God spoke all these words." There is no clarifier to who he is talking to. And I think it is explained helpfully, not here, but elsewhere, It is explained in Deuteronomy 4 to 5, especially Deuteronomy 4, 10 to 14. And maybe after this week, during this week, I'd challenge you to maybe go read Deuteronomy 4 to 5, get another perspective on this event. But there in that text, in the flow of this text here, it seems to indicate that the Ten Commandments were given by the voice of God for all the people to hear. So what's interesting, we just read that the voice of God is as thunder. We read elsewhere that the voice of God shook the ground. And that is the voice that delivers these Ten Commandments. There is a weight here. We read in verses 18 to 21 that the presence and the voice of God terrifies the people so much that they ask Moses to go speak to God for them so that they will not be killed by such proximity to God's presence. This is a response that Moses himself had in chapter 3 and that we see throughout Scripture when people realize that they are in the presence of God. Moses tells the people not to fear, for God has come not to kill, but to demonstrate his power and his holiness, that the people may have a proper reverence for God and to be deterred, that they may be deterred from sinning or from breaking the covenant that they are about to enter. His response sounds very similar to the response of Jesus and others throughout the Bible. Moses then goes back up the mountain to receive the statutes and rules seen in the end of 21 through the end of 23, and we'll get to those next week. But that's what he goes up to do at the end of this section here. What we're going to spend the rest of the time though looking at is the Ten Commandments. This address by God to the people that they heard, that they felt. So the ground shook under them. These Ten Commandments serve as a summary, as a core to the covenant, which is why they are given for all the people to hear. The commands stand on their own. They are given before any other commands to summarize everything that comes after them. They are the heart of the Mosaic Law. The list of commands we see in 20, 22 to 23, 33, and the lists we see elsewhere throughout the Old Testament, then finally in the Sermon on the Mount and in the Epistles, apply these commands more specifically to contexts to which they are written. Jesus reinforces this concept and summarizes the law even more succinctly in two great commandments. He takes the ten and turns them into two, because as we will see, they all boil down to exactly what Jesus says. Love God. Love others. The Ten Commandments begin with a call to exclusive belief and loyalty to God, as we see in the first 11 verses, or what we tend to call the first four commandments. I'm going to read the Ten Commandments before we start working through them. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is on heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I am the Lord your God. I am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of your Lord in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your livestock or your sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that your Lord, the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's. Now when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled and they stood far off and said to Moses, you speak to us, and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us, lest we die. Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, and that you may not sin." The people stood far off, and Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. Again, as we work through these Ten Commandments, we have to remember that they are seated in the story of Israel. This is why the Ten Commandments start with God saying, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." This serves as a summary of everything that had just happened, the whole book up till now. God's deliverance, his victory over the gods of Egypt and Pharaoh, his presence, provision, and protection on the journey from Egypt here to Mount Sinai. Remember how we repeatedly heard the purpose statement, "You shall know that I am the Lord"? The people know. They have seen. They have heard. They have experienced that he is Yahweh, the covenant God, who causes all things to be. He is the creator God above all of his creation. Now they are called to respond with belief and loyalty. He calls them first to have no other gods before me. Remember how it's in a story here? Have no other gods before me. I just defeated all of Egypt's gods. Have no other god before me. I did that in Egypt, and I will do that to every land that you are going to. For no god compares to me. So have no other god before me. He is the Lord of all, and he is to be worshipped as such. He then calls them to not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or in the earth beneath, or in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. They are not to make an image of anything to worship, for God, through the plagues, through his acts of deliverance and provision and protection, has just shown that he is above all creation. There is no picture that you can draw of God, for he is the uncreated creator. There is nothing you can worship. The command, though, is not to not make images. That's clarified within the command itself. God literally tells people to make images in the tabernacle. But the first imperative that we see in this command, to not make an image, is clarified by the second imperative we see, which is don't bow down to them. These images in the temple, they weren't God. They weren't something to be worshipped. They were created by God. And they're part of your experience as you learn to worship God alone, nothing else. We see later in the tabernacle and in the temple that there was no image of God to worship. In this context, in this world, this would have been really, really strange. Every other temple had an image to the God that it was built for. However, God commanded that there be no image in his house, for he is not of his creation. He is not created. He also had already made man in the image of God. And I think there is a teaching here as well about this. And one day he will also send the perfect image of the invisible God. I think hidden here in the prohibition against images is the promise of God giving his perfect image one day in his Son. We read of Jesus that to see him is to see the Father. For in him the fullness of deity dwells bodily. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. So here in the Old Covenant, he says, do not make an image of me to worship. But then in the New Covenant, he sends his image. And him we can worship because he is God. And he images God for us. The people are also reminded in this command that God is a jealous God. The word here used of God's jealousy is comparable to the jealousy of a married spouse. This reminds us that God is not indifferent to his creation. This isn't a take it or leave it covenant. This is the entrance that is metaphorically spoken of as a marriage relationship. And we see that throughout the Bible. We'll even see that a bit in some of the actions and events in the golden calf incident. We'll get there later. But God cannot be indifferent to his creation. This is why faith and loyalty to God are described in marriage terms throughout the Old and New Testaments. And notice also here the difference between God's punishment and his blessing. To the third and the fourth generation for punishment versus to the thousandth generation, which I would argue would be a better translation than what the ESV has here, but to the thousandth generation a blessing. This is explained more later in Exodus 34 to mean that God's anger is slow but pointed. But his love and his faithfulness is abounding. And we will see this all throughout Israel's story, and we see it all throughout our story as well. God is abounding in love and faithfulness. That is why we're all still breathing. Let's be honest. The third command is to not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. This command is about much more than not using his name as a swear word. It's probably a good place to start, but it's about much more than that. The word here to take is about carrying or imaging his name in vain. And yes, I am bringing up imaging a lot because it's kind of a big deal in the covenant. It is about not carrying or imaging his name in vain. This in vain word has multiple meanings, and I think it's used on purpose because it includes all of them. It can mean to carry or image his name falsely or hypocritically. It could be used to mean to carry or image his name worthlessly or disparagingly, to bring dishonor to him. It has the idea of a phrase that we use today to bring shame to the family name. That's the idea here, that we carry, that we have God's name if we claim faith in him. And are we honoring that? Are we respecting that? Or are we bringing shame to it and disparaging it and rubbing it through the mud? Or using it for things that he would in no way want to be associated with? The people had just been called, as you remember in the last chapter, to be a kingdom of priests. They are to be called to those who image God, those who carry his name in a way that honors him. That's what this commandment is about. And then the fourth commandment is to remember the Sabbath. The teachings about Sabbath, as we discussed last week, started back in Exodus 16, so I won't rehash all of them. But this is to be a day of rest, shared with God, just as he rested. And just as I talked in the last one, there's more going on to just our English word rest. This Hebrew word rest here has a lot more packed inside of it than we can possibly do with just one little English word. This word has the idea of sitting down or settling down or resting or abiding, being at rest somewhere. This has the idea of being at home with God. God created the universe and then chose to rest or settle down to abide in the creation that he had just made. He created the garden as a place where he could fellowship with the people that he had just created. This is a weekly reminder that God longs to be with people. This is a weekly reminder that they are called to find their ultimate rest, their ultimate home, their ultimate Sabbath with him. And that is why this Sabbath theme, as we continue throughout the Bible, this Sabbath theme is picked up and extended and developed to ultimately the new heaven and new earth, where we have forever rest, forever home with him. That's what the Sabbath is a picture of. It is a weekly reminder that that is the goal. God is striving and constantly unfolding his plan to bring back Eden. So these first commands are all ultimately about loving God. And that theme will be continued. The theme of belief and loyalty and loving God will be continued throughout the last six commands, but they are applied more specifically into the context of loving others. The fifth command, to honor your father and mother. Notice that there is no time limit. And also one parent is not honored over the other parent. We see there's a parallel command in Leviticus that actually flips the order to make this even more clear. Here we read, honor your father and mother. The Leviticus text reads, honor your mother and father, so that they are both honored. This helps us also, I'm sorry, I skipped my notes. The word honor and the word revere that's used in the Leviticus text, these commands, these words as commands given by somebody to do this, to be called to do this, these are only used in reference to parents and to God. I think there is a teaching here and a helpful clarification here that I think this command has something to do with the command that we just talked about bearing God's name in vain. I think the two are related. I think it also helps us to know how to apply this command here to honor your father and mother. We are not to demean or to devalue them. We are to not humiliate them. We are to not to disparage them. We are not to carry the family name in vain. Even married children are called to honor their parents. In this context, in fact, they would have lived in the same tent or very nearby, and the family was the core of the entire culture. To dishonor the parents was to tear at the very fabric of society. This command, though, is not about blind obedience. This command is about honoring and revering and seeking their best as we ultimately obey God, which I think is also couched in the fact that these verbs are used of God and of parents. We are to honor and revere God and our parents in that order. The next command, you shall not murder. The word used for kill in general is not used here. The word is better translated as murder, or taking innocent life, or an illegal killing. It also, however, can refer to unintentional killing through carelessness and negligence. The verb is never used of the administrative of justice, or in war, or in God's judgment of people. Life is God's alone to give and to take. Therefore, to murder is to attempt to usurp God, and to not take proper care or concern to protect life shows a disregard for God's image bearers. And I think that's why you have both applications in this verb here, to intentionally or even to unintentionally through your own carelessness to cause death. We are to show due respect to the humanity that God has created and chosen to make in his image. The seventh command, you shall not commit adultery. We'll discuss this more later, but adultery is defined in the Old Testament as having relations with someone who is married or betrothed or engaged, or a married woman having relations with somebody who is not her husband. I'm going to address the elephant in the room here and just note that polygamy is not prohibited, and levirate marriage, which we've discussed in other contexts, is prescribed when needed. Polygamy, I would argue, like slavery, is part of the culture that God does not overturn, but rather sets safeguards and guidelines to prohibit abuse. It is not set up anywhere in the Bible as the ideal, but it was part of the culture that actually helped to protect women since there was no social safety net. The things that are prohibited by this verb, by this command here, are those that will harm others and destroy family units. The eighth command, you shall not steal. The word is purposely broad to cover any type of theft. Theft devalues others and creates distrust in the culture. The ninth command, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. The language used here is judicial language. The context is a legal context. Everyone is a potential witness, and a false witness hinders administration of justice and undermines the integrity of the system itself. A false witness, as we see elsewhere, is given the same punishment as what would have resulted from their statement. And the witnesses had to be the first ones to initiate the death penalty. This command, then, is to protect the innocent and to punish evil. Again, this legal context here, saying, use your words, use your testimony to protect the innocent and to punish evil. It does not forbid being tactful or protecting life. It does not forbid, to take it to an extreme, it does not forbid surprise birthday parties. It also does not forbid, to make even more ridiculous, to show the point of making an extreme of it, it does not prohibit trick moves in sports. If somebody looks right and passes left, they are not dishonoring this command. That's not the point. The point is, are you using your words to protect the innocent and to aid in the punishment of evil. This command is similar to the command about murder. Just as in that command, a certain type of killing was prohibited, so in this command, a certain type of lying or untruth or partial truth, a certain type of that is prohibited. The midwives are blessed even though they lie to protect life. Rahab is blessed for lying to protect life. They protect the innocent. I would argue they honor this command. God is explicitly shown to use deception and partial truth multiple times. Now that may sound heretical, but it is literally in the Bible that God uses partial truths, half-truths. He uses deception. Samuel was told to say that he was going to make a sacrifice, not to anoint David. Now, he did actually make the sacrifice, so there's that. But that wasn't actually the ultimate reason that he was going, and he and God knew that very well. Moses, as we discussed already, was to ask that the people be allowed to travel 3 days to make a sacrifice, though God told him that the plan all along was that the people are going to leave. And we've worked through that. God gives Joshua a battle plan that includes an ambush. And an ambush is inherently a deception. God uses deception. God uses partial truths. All of the incidences that we just worked through with what God is doing, all of them are part of God's act of judgment to punish evil. Just like I said at the beginning, protect the innocent and punish evil. God is using them, those times where he uses half-truth or deception, he uses that to judge in those contexts that we talked about, Saul, Pharaoh and the Egyptians, and then later on Ai, or I, however you want to say it. But he is using this to punish evil. So I wanted to pause there a little bit, because this command can be a little confusing, and I honestly grew up feeling really guilty about surprise parties and different white lies like that. But I'd argue we have to know what's going on here in the heart of this command to know what's being prohibited specifically. And then the final command is, you shall not covet. This is a prohibition against obsessive jealousy that leads to the violation of any of the first nine. And that is why I would argue that it is put last. To harbor this attitude in your heart can lead to the violation of any of the commands that just came before. To covet, to be jealous of, to want so much that you are willing to violate one of the other commands. It is put here as a summary of the type of heart that would commit any of the ones going before. So these commands, this summary of the law, is a call to love God and love others. It is a call to live out the belief and the loyalty of the people by worshiping God above all else and by living in line with his character. It is a call to worship God, to image him to the world around them, and to live well with each other. It doesn't sound so bad when you put it that way. I think this is why Paul said the law was good and perfect. There are a lot more laws that we will explain and apply that apply the 10 more specifically to the people and in their context, but this is the heart. Love God, love others. Then and now, Old Covenant and New Covenant, we are called to believing loyalty that is lived out in the words of Christ as loving the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and loving your neighbor as yourself. I wanted to look at just this opening part of the covenant because, one, it's got the Ten Commandments. There's a lot of content there already. But then also because it is easy to lose the simplicity. The Pharisees did. It is easy to lose the simplicity, the heart of this covenant, if we don't view everything that follows through this lens. As we continue through all the laws that we are about to read, we have to keep the heart of the covenant in mind. That's what Jesus was always calling his followers to and always calling out in the Pharisees and the religious teachers. I also wanted to take some time to discuss believing loyalty and how this is what God has always called his people to. It is easy to struggle with doubts of our salvation, as I'm sure many of us have struggled. And part of the struggle is our struggle to understand the relationship between works and faith. Old and New Covenant, works have nothing to do with salvation. Belief does. Works are the living out of our belief through loyalty to God and his instructions for how we live well. Works show that we do believe. This is why James says faith without works is dead. This is not contradictory to Paul. What James is saying is that a proclamation of faith that has no evidence of actual faith shows itself to be false by not living in belief. The call, though, is not to perfection. God knows we are human. He knows our frame. Read the stories of the Bible. Read the supposed hall of faith and how imperfect those people were. But what they had was faith. What they had was believing loyalty. When they failed, when they fell, when they sinned, they repented. That's the difference between Saul and David. Saul failed. He chose to rebel against God. And when he was called out, he made excuses. When David was called out, we get Psalm 51, one of the most glorious psalms of repentance. The call is not to perfection, but are we characterized by believing loyalty to God, shown in our love for him and for others? When we fail, when we sin, do we repent? If these things characterize you, then you are his child. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for this text. I thank you for the opening ceremony, if you will, of your covenant. I thank you for your Ten Commandments and the call that they are and the instruction and the help that they are to us as we seek to show that we believe in you, as we seek to worship you and honor you in our relationship with you and with others. I thank you that you have helped us by instructing us how to do that, that you have revealed yourself and your character to us and called us to the best way to live. And I pray that as we look to you, that in our belief in you, that we would live it and that we would demonstrate it, and that our faith would guide our lives, that we would show through our obedience that we do believe in you. And I thank you that it doesn't have to be the other way around, that we don't have to earn a relationship with you, but that where it all starts is faith and belief in what you have done for us, how you sent your son to do what we couldn't do, to live a perfect life for us and take our sin on the cross so that we could cry out to you through his work, through his sacrifice for us, that we need you, that we believe in what you have done for us and how you have made a way for us to have fellowship with you and how you are our God and our creator. And I pray that as the Israelites saw you and chose to believe in you and enter into covenant with you, that we too would acknowledge you and that we would believe you and what you have done for us and how you've revealed yourself to us. And I thank you that you have, that you loved us enough to do that. I pray all this in your name. Amen.